This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Brocast. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network. And I'm coming to you with an actual co-host this week, Tracy Pearson. Tracy, how are you?
Wow. I'm good, Dave. I was flying to, to San Jose last week. I could have tried to do it on my Southwest flight, maybe do a podcast in air.
Go Wi-Fi, baby.
Yeah. I don't think that would have worked out too well, actually.
I think it would have been cool. It would have been fun.
I watched a movie I highly, highly recommend. It's called Past Lives. Have you seen it?
Mm-mm.
Really good, with an actress, Greta Lee. It's got some Korean subtitles, but also in English. It's really good. Great movie. I recommend. Okay. Sorry.
You watched a whole movie on the flight to San Jose?
No, I watched half going up and half coming back.
Wow. That's...
Yeah.
That's
and
big.
And I that's... needed to see the end, and we landed, and and we're... disembarking, I go, I got to see the end of this movie for about another minute. Yeah.
Wow.
It was good, dude. It was very good.
Wow. All right. Well, we've got a movie recommendation. We are ready to go. We are raring to go.
I'm raring.
All right. So this week, UCLA takes on Colorado. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about some things we've heard from basketball practice. But we want to start with football talk. UCLA did pretty much what anyone rational would have expected against Stanford in pancaking them. I, of course, didn't predict that because I am I'm going for a new streak, Tracy. I want to see if I can go 1-10 against the spread on UCLA games this year.
Oh, where are you right now?
I'm 1-5. And
which
that's
one
only...
did you get? Which is the one?
Well, that's the funny part, is I only got the opener when I had the least information possible about this team.
So you were 1-0, and you're thinking, I'm feeling this.
I'm feeling it. And I predicted the exact spread in that game. Like, I had 14 points in my preview. It was a 14-point game. And since then, it's been pure disaster.
What's the trend, Dave? Are you underestimating?
No, there's no trend.
No trend.
No trend.
You're just randomly missing.
I could be flipping a coin, and it's just wrong, wrong, wrong every single time.
So that's your takeaway, guys, from this pot, bro. It's the information you're getting. It's just flipping a coin.
Pretty much coin flipping.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, I do my Pac-12 picks, like I do my weekly viewing guide. I'm like at 65% if you take out the UCLA games. It's insane. I don't know what's going on.
You're too. Pretty easy. I mean, you're just too close.
Too close to the situation. I got to back away.
It's a problem with humans. You get too close, you can't judge anything, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's where we are.
I mean, you're out there in the middle of Spalding Field every day. You're too close.
Well, so if you read my Stanford
preview... With a GoPro
preview,
on.
If you read my Stanford preview, I think you would have... If you didn't see my score prediction, you, the listener, you would have said, oh, yeah, they'll win by like 28. But I ended up picking 31-17. Because I'm like, I'm going to hedge against Ethan Garber's starting. I'm going to hedge against, X, Y, or Z. And,
I guess the question there is, and this is hindsight, how did you think Stanford would...
ever score 17 points. They scored 46 on Colorado the previous week. Of course, that was in double overtime.
Colorado is one of the worst defenses in America.
We're going to get to that in a second. So anyway, UCLA won that game by 35. Obviously, there were some, you know, Stanford Gonzo penalties that made that more of a blowout than it probably was.
Wow, it's so true, Dave. You texted me and said, I'm rewatching this game, and then I rewatched it. The penalties were, as a UCLA fan, you might not have noticed, they were a major factor in that game.
It was insane. And like they were, and I don't mean to say, like a couple of them, I thought like the holding, I think, was a little bit ticky tack on their tight end. But most of them were true penalties, but they were all not advantage plays. Like not a single one was Stanford getting an advantage on it. And they were almost all wiping out really, really successful plays.
Significant plays. Yeah.
Or on the other end, wiping out incompletions where they would just stupidly get a late hit on Ethan Garbers. It was really stupid, and that's, you know, that's part of what's built into playing against a bad team, is that bad teams do stupid stuff. So I don't mean to like take away from it, but from like an actual gameplay standpoint, it wasn't a 35-point win. It was probably like a 3-touchdown win. Still would have covered.
Yeah. It really stood out. It really, though, very much stood out.
Yeah.
You were right. You nailed that. Did you write that?
I did. I didn't want to hit it too hard, and I don't want to hit it too hard right now because it was still going to be a blowout win, and I don't want people to say we're naysaying a win.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then, so
Stanford is one of the most penalized teams.
Like, yeah, Stanford is, and
penalties.
Yeah, bad teams generally correlate. I mean, earmuffs, Jim Mora. Bad teams generally correlate with a lot of penalties.
Generally, but other teams that are supposed to be good, because UCLA is 108th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Not great. So, okay, that's setting the stage. UCLA, we were talking about this 4-game stretch, which has kind of become a 2-game stretch, of lesser opponents that UCLA would be able to feast upon. First was Stanford, and they blew them out. And the next one, and I want people to really get this into their heads, is Colorado. Colorado is 4-3. They've had some wins. They beat TCU on the road. They beat ASU. They beat Nebraska. They beat Colorado State. What all those teams have in common is that none of them are good. TCU is probably the best of the bunch. They're not very good. Colorado is best understood as a team that has, like Stanford, an absolutely horrible defense, one of the worst you're going to see this year, a very bad rushing attack, and then just kind of miraculously in the middle of it all, an elite passing attack. Shedeur Sanders is, for my money, by far the most accurate quarterback in the Pac-12. He makes throws from the pocket with extreme accuracy. He makes throws on the move with extreme accuracy. He is amazing at putting the ball exactly where it needs to go. He's also a reasonably good athlete. He doesn't actually run the ball that much. So the idea that he's going to be a significant dual threat, unless he really changes his behavior this year, there's almost no chance of that. And what he does, that's probably his only major deficiency as a quarterback, is that he hangs in and hangs in and hangs in and wants so badly to make a pass play that he takes an inordinate number of sacks.
And you know what that means to me?
Yeah, I do.
And I was, as you were saying that, one of the worst teams in the country for sack percentage, for protecting their quarterback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How's that going to shake out against UCLA?
Yeah.
So there's, and I just finished writing my preview. That'll go up later today, probably well after this podcast, but there isn't a statistical or analytical reason to think that Colorado is going to make this a game. There just isn't. They don't. So their defense, it's slightly better against the run than the pass. But by that, I mean it's a horrible run defense and one of the most abominable pass defenses I've ever seen. UCLA will be able to move the ball effectively. And then it's just hard to imagine a team that is one-dimensional passing the ball really having a ton of success against UCLA's defense.
You know, just overall, if you're looking at matchups, UCLA moving forward, I wrote that article early in the week. that said UCLA will match up very well against most of its remaining opponents. UCLA, knowing what we know of this team now and having watched them, you want the strength of this team, which is its defense, to go against a stronger, if you were ideally setting up for it, could be a tough game. You'd want UCLA's offense to have an easy go with a pretty bad defense. If there had to be a strength of the opposition, you'd want it to be their offense, because you'd put up UCLA's defense against really any yep. offense. So that's the overview. Now, if you break it down into really details, that matchup, yes, Colorado has a great passing game, but that element, what you just said, they don't protect the quarterback. He hangs in too long. If there's a good offense, and its one weakness is that it allows sacks, that would be just about the ideal matchup you'd want for UCLA's good defense against an opposing team's good offense, right?
Yeah. And so if you're going to, I want to give full context because I want people to fully get it. So Colorado may get their, probably their best offensive lineman, Savion Washington, back for this game. He plays right tackle. But he didn't miss the whole season. He missed a couple of games. And this was a bad, bad, bad offensive line before he got hurt. And it's probably going to continue to be a bad offensive line. Sanders has also run the ball a little bit more in recent weeks. And I think that has been as they've realized that this team still has a lot of deficiencies. I think his coach, his father, has said, hey, you got to run it a little bit more because we still have a lot of work to do to get up to a bowl game. So will he run the ball 25 times? No, but he'll scramble out and leak out. The thing is, UCLA against these semi-dual threats this year, they just stick Carl Jones on him, and Carl Jones is playing the most disciplined football of his life, and they don't get any traction running the ball. I mean, Cam Ward occasionally makes plays with his legs, kind of similarly to Shedeur Sanders, and they completely shut that down. Didn't even allow him the avenue to try. So there's just, I'm trying to think of, like, what I always try to do when I write these things is, what's the scenario where Colorado could actually win? And it involves so many uncharacteristic blunders from UCLA.
To me, it would be that Shedeur Sanders finds a way to extend plays. If there is a weakness of UCLA's pass rush, is that it struggles sometimes to get home. Great pressure, but then, damn, just bring the guy to the ground already. It's frustrating. He's a little mobile, but not greatly mobile. You assume he's because he's been under fire so much and he moves so much, you think he's really mobile. His ability to extend plays, because UCLA's weakness defensively is its secondary. So that's the one little crevice of possibility for Colorado's offense, I think. And that will be that's going to be very interesting to watch on that side of the ball. If you're done with that side, the other side to me is almost going to be, it seems like it wouldn't be as interesting because it's not a great offense against not a great defense, but it is going to be interesting to me because Colorado's defense is probably about as good as Stanford's. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Stanford's might literally be the worst in college football this year. Colorado's is not quite there, but it is in the bottom 20.
Yeah.
For sure.
So first off, just I want to say this. Like I think you wrote it in your review. Anyone could have looked fairly good. Quarterback, offense, playing against Stanford's defense. We can't take a lot from UCLA's win over Stanford. We can't take a lot from the offensive performance. And here's the thing. It was against, like what you're saying, the worst defense in the country. And it wasn't really a dominating performance. It was more workmanlike, grinded out against that defense. So I would not say you can come away from that game saying, wow, UCLA's offense is back on track. There are still like at least one asterisk for UCLA's offense. But it is facing another really, really horrendous defense. It will be interesting. Colorado's rushing defense is really not good, similar to Stanford's. I'm interested because, you know, I'm into the nuance and the X's and O's. Will Colorado look at the Stanford game and say, hey, wasn't a bad game plan. Let's stack the box, keep them from running, and make Ethan Garbers beat us, and maybe spy Ethan Garbers a little so he doesn't run for five first downs on third and long. That will be interesting to see if that defense is even capable of doing that. But I would think that they'll come out with that same game plan. They don't want UCLA just to run through them. They're going to stack the box and limit that running game. And then along those lines, I think UCLA needs a better game plan and a better play calling, especially in its running game. It was just too cute in that game. Let's get away from, this offensive line doesn't zone block very well, but let's just go man blocking and run it at them instead of that attempt at misdirection thing. I don't know what that was. Anyway, I'm going to find that other matchup on the other side of the ball probably just as interesting to see what Colorado's defense does.
So Colorado's defense, the run defense is bad. The pass defense is horrible. They allow a lot of efficiency. They don't. If there's a relative strength, so two relative strengths, they pressure the quarterback. They don't actually get a lot of sacks, but they do pressure the quarterback. And they are slightly better at preventing explosive plays. So probably think of them as pretty good tackling in the secondary.
Slightly better than whom?
Than themselves at preventing efficiency. Their relative strengths are preventing explosive plays and rushing the passer. But again, not sacking them, just putting them under pressure. Safety play is okay. Now here's some weird stuff that's happening this week. They're taking one of their starting safeties, and he's more than likely going to start at linebacker because they have some depth at safety, and linebacker play has been atrocious. And they've had just kind of musical chairs at linebacker. One of their starters has missed the last two games for undisclosed reasons. It sounds disciplinary, Jawan Mitchell. They've got Marvin Ham. They've got musical chairs there, and none of these guys are very good. They've been really, really reluctant to play multiple linebackers. They've played very, very coverage-based defenses. I'm very interested to see if they adjust out of that. I don't think their defensive coordinator, Charles Kelly, is very good. There's so many situations, if you watch Colorado, where they've got basically one true linebacker on the field, and he's responsible for the entire middle of the defense, and it's just stupid looking. And it's, you know, Jawan Mitchell, who's pretty good sideline to sideline, just having to run literally from sideline to sideline to track down ball carriers. It's insane to watch. Not particularly well schemed. I don't know if they will take the lesson from Stanford at all. Maybe they will, but their defense seems very geared towards playing coverage and hoping for the best up front, and the best has not worked out. At cornerback, they have Travis Hunter back, and then on the other side, it's been a couple of different guys, Amarion Cooper and Carter Stoutmeyer, and then there's also Cormani McClain. Besides Hunter, none of them really tackle well. What I would probably do is kind of the same thing, where if you're playing Ethan Garbers, he's not super effective throwing downfield. So a lot of efficiency running, a lot of, you know, short passes outside, force those corners to tackle, build some explosive plays that way. I mean, TJ Harden, I'd be surprised if he doesn't have a couple of 20 plus yard runs in this game. And then once they pull their safeties up, you'll get a couple of shots late. But I think it's going to be very similar to Stanford, honestly, where they're going to do a lot of efficiency running. I think it's going to be Carson Steele grinding out a lot of, you know, what they were against Stanford. I think Stanford had, it got some really inspired play up front. Their defensive tackle, I don't even know his name, he was doing a good job against Duke Clemens the entire game. I don't know if Colorado has the pieces to do that. I think Carson Steele is going to get a lot of five-yard runs, a lot of six-yard runs. There'll be some plays like they were doing with J. Mike against Stanford where just get him the ball right around the line of scrimmage and let him make a play with his legs on the move. And then, you know, hopefully hit a few plays late. But I think it's going to be a lot of, you know, grinding drives. It'll probably depress the scoring output slightly from what you would expect, but I still think they'll score in the 30s.
Yeah. You know, you talked about the running game, T.J. Hardin and Carson Steele. Interesting about Keegan Jones. He was dressed for the game last week against Stanford. He looked fine. He didn't play, right?
Yeah.
And then you saw him out of practice, and you thought he had a wrap on?
No.
What was it?
I thought he looked fine the first day. I didn't see him on Wednesday.
Didn't see him on Wednesday?
Yeah.
That's a curious thing. Because I personally think Carson Steele and T.J. Hardin have been fine. I think the backfield overall lacks quickness and explosiveness. I think they're leaving some yards on the field. There are times when I'm watching this game, watching UCLA play, and I just say, there's the hole. Nope, didn't hit it. I keep repeating that over and over to myself watching UCLA's offense. I'd really like to see Keegan Jones get some more carries from scrimmage, but it's a mystery of whether he'll be available. Didn't play last game, wasn't at practice yesterday on Wednesday. So that's a curiosity. That's something to be looking for, I think.
So with that, Carson Steele, just so everyone has some stats, this year he's been reasonably effective, right? 5.3 yards per carry. When you look at what that makeup is, you'll be reminded that your eyes aren't lying to you. He's only averaging 1.6 yards before contact per carry. T.J. Hardin is averaging 3.8 yards before contact per carry. Now, they're running behind the same offensive line, so it makes you wonder, why is that happening? And this is what we've been talking about a few times, and it got me some virulent hate on the message board, but Carson Steele doesn't have a great burst. And so guys catch him from behind at the line of scrimmage. Stanford did it again where they just crashed with the outside linebacker and he's able to run down Steele from behind. That doesn't happen with Hardin as much.
Yeah.
So now after contact, Carson Steele's absolutely an elite back. He's got 4 yards after contact, which is pretty crazy. Like that's a significant yardage total after contact. He's got his strength, but that combination is why you don't see a lot of explosive plays from him, because he's hitting contact so early all the time. T.J. Hardin, the reason he's getting explosive plays is, yes, he's a little bit faster, but it's that initial burst. He's not hitting contact as early as often, and so there's more room for him to get up to speed and get out into the open field. Now, Keegan Jones, I saw too much of him running out of the backfield. I like the way they've used him. I don't know what's going on with him, why he didn't play in the last game. I'd like to see them continue to use him in the same way. Roll him out of the slot, make him, you know, do some odd things, especially off tackle. But running between the tackles, I've seen too much of that.
I think he's gotten better. You saw too much of it 2 years ago. And admittedly, you were right. I think he is, from what we've seen of him when he's carried the ball, I think his vision has improved. And while I like to see him used the way he was, I'd also like to see him running between the tackle and just getting a straight handoff to see what that kind of quickness, initial quickness, hitting a hole might do. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with me that you look at some of these running plays and you think they're leaving yards on the field, that they just aren't hitting the hole that is open? A lot of times when you're zone blocking, it's not one hole. The running back has an option on where he can go, and they're just not picking it, and they're not fast enough to get there. Do you agree?
I agree with Steele. I think Harden's done a generally better job. I think he's gotten tunnel vision in the last few games, but I think he's generally done a better job. I think Steele gets caught from behind a lot.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
CBS Wednesday.
We have so many cool, diverse people from different backgrounds, different beliefs, different upbringings, and it just keeps growing.
I'm a citizen of the United States.
I'm a hustler.
I'm a big Taylor Swift fan.
I'm the queen of the tribe. I'm a
survivor. I am playing whatever role I gotta play.
I'm gonna play this game full speed.
I ain't going down like no punk.
A new Survivor, Wednesday on CBS and streaming on Paramount Plus.
The other thing I like to say, I do believe, even though a quarterback has his progressions, he might have hot receivers, it really does come down to, you know, when you were in middle school and you were playing Sandlot and you had your favorite receiver and you just kept throwing the ball to him, there's still that element of whether of the guys that you like. While I think UCLA's offense is trying to target J. Michael Sturdivant and maybe Kyle Ford a little bit more, I think there's an element here that Ethan Garbers likes those guys and recognizes their talent, and I think he will be looking for them, and we saw it against Stanford. I personally think that this offense, to keep developing and delivering on its potential, they just got to get more targets for J. Michael Sturdivant. We saw what happened in San Diego State when he didn't even catch the ball. You know, he's drawing PI calls. It just, I think it's been a real wasted opportunity not to take advantage of him. Maybe, perhaps, with Ethan Garbers, they will. That will happen. I think that's key. The other thing I'd like to bring up is this whole thing about a bye, where everyone says, you know, team is going to benefit from the bye. Colorado had a bye last week. UCLA's been on the road 2 weeks in a row. Do we really think a bye is beneficial? More often than not, we've come away from games after byes and thought, wow, they were flat. So
totally depends on the coach. And I think a lot of times, I know UCLA after byes has been generally pretty bad under Chip Kelly. And I think it depends on how you use it. You know, I think you're right. I mean, a lot of times they come out flat. They come out looking like they're rusty, looking like they haven't practiced enough. Because a lot of times people use a bye as like a break week, where they're, you know, only practicing once or twice in the week off, which, you know, I think it gets you out of rhythm.
And then the other thing we have to talk about with this game, and I'm doing air quotes right now, it's sold out.
Mm-hmm.
At 67,000, I think maybe.
I think they bumped it up to 70. 70. I think they removed like three tarps.
So they had removed three, then they removed three more.
Yeah.
There's a total of 12. So whether you want to call that a, I don't call that a sellout. I mean, you cover up a part of your stadium and then you call it a sellout. You could cover up 50,000 seats and call it a sellout. So I don't think you can call it a sellout, but regardless, it's going to be UCLA's biggest attended game, home game at the Rose Bowl this year. I think we can safely say that.
No doubt, yeah.
There are going to be celebrities on the sidelines. There's going to be a lot of attention in this game. It's funny, people were making this point on the forum. This UCLA program is used to operating in semi-obscurity. Under Chip Kelly, really, what have been the big profile games? Oregon last year, LSU.
I mean, USC last year.
USC, very infrequently has there been a game where it used to be there were four or five of them per every year.
Yep.
It'll be obviously Colorado's used to it. It'll be interesting, and I don't know. I'm asking the question. Does that, if you've been playing in the Rose Bowl in front of, what have they averaged so far this season? Like 38,000, maybe? And suddenly the crowd's electric, and even though it's a pro UCLA crowd, there still is, it's a different environment. And it'll be interesting to see how UCLA handles that. It might not matter at all. They might get energy from it. They might get the vibe. But that's another factor just to maybe think about in this game. It's the one high-profile game of the season at the Rose Bowl, which is a testament to how bad the scheduling is.
Alternate unis, baby.
And alternate uniforms.
Yeah.
I'm hearing they're sold out of those uniforms. We can actually use the term sold out with the alternate jerseys. A friend of mine tried to buy them and couldn't get one.
So my feeling on the capacity thing is don't remove three tarps. Remove them all. And the Rose Bowl, when there's at least, 60,000 people there, 65,000 people there, it looks full. It looks cool. Like, just open it all up. So, I don't know. I mean, I think there's one side of it that you can probably just leave, but remove whatever is remaining on the other side. So anyway, there's that. But yeah, that's a point. I think it's going to be a lot of celebrities witness to Colorado getting blown out, more than likely. I do want to touch on one thing from just the receiver group, because I think you hit some really important points there with J. Mike and Kyle Ford. They're both, I mean, they're both obviously effective when they catch the ball. J. Mike's averaging almost 18 yards a catch. Most importantly, their drop rates are pretty decent. Logan Loya and Josiah Norwood are each dropping the ball a ton this year. And they're each being targeted. So Logan Loya is the second most targeted receiver on the team by rate. Josiah Norwood has run 31 routes this year, according to Bill Connolly's stats, and he's been targeted on half of them.
That's phenomenal.
These two guys have been really, really, really big factors in the passing game, and their play has not been enough for that. Like, they've each been targeted a ton for when they're on the field. Logan Loya has a drop rate of 8.3%. Josiah Norwood's is almost 20%. It's one of those things that's just kind of baffling.
What's Kyle Ford's?
Because he's 5.9 and J. Mike's is 5.1. Cam Brown is at 0.0%.
Hasn't dropped a ball.
He's running a lot of routes out there, and he is just not getting targeted at all. So I don't know. I mean, there's some wonky stuff going on here. I don't know what it is, but it is, I think, depressing the overall potential efficiency and explosiveness of this passing attack. Just who they are choosing to target and in what situations. I mean, I'm not meaning to pick on him, really. I think he's done some really nice things. But Loya's dropped how many first down balls on, like, critical third downs?
If you don't have the stat, at least three or four.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's tough when, because these are the guys that you're running out of the slot a lot of times who are your, essentially, your possession receivers in this offense. And that's what's happening. That's not great.
The other thing I wanted to talk about is the, kind of related to the article that I wrote earlier in the week. For UCLA to live up to expectation now at this point in the season, it's win out or bust. It's 10 or 2. 10 and 2 as a record. I think now, at this point in the season, we know what this UCLA team is. We know what the opponents are and the rest of the upcoming schedule. It's so funny how this hits people's brains when you say something like this. Other people say, oh, well, that's not expectation. That should be prediction. Whatever word you're arguing of what it is. But if you just really think about this right now, USC is the only ranked team remaining on the schedule. The theory is they might not be ranked by the time they UCLA goes to the Coliseum November
USC,
19th.
Yes. I will guarantee you USC will not be ranked when okay. UCLA and USC play.
Dave is guaranteeing it. I'm saying that might happen, but let's just say there's a good possibility. Yeah, could UCLA trip up? Do they trip up a lot? Yes. Should we expect, as UCLA fans, for UCLA's sixth year in Chip Kelly's program to have a year where they don't trip up? They actually play really well throughout the season and live up to, when I say expectation, how good this team is comparatively to its upcoming opponents. It should be 10-2. That would be, and what I was also saying, that would make this season a success. It's awfully hard to say this season's a success if UCLA doesn't beat USC. You know, they'd have to be 11-1, and that would be the one loss, in my opinion.
That's not the one I'm concerned about.
Okay. But what I'm saying is, to say this is successful, I just don't get the acceptance of, let's say, 9-3 and a loss at USC, and you're saying, oh, no, that was a good year. And trying to weave in and discount in that UCLA is going to trip up. Well, then that would not be a successful season. Expectations are so tweaked in the mind, and I don't even know if it's BBS, Dave. I don't know where we are with this. I'm not saying that UCLA should just overachieve and get to 10-2. This is readily attainable given this team and its opponents. It doesn't have to beat a top 15, top 20 team on the road. I thought it was insane, some of the reactions. I'm just going to say it. From writing that article, you would have thought I would have said UCLA needs to win out against five top 15 teams or it's not a successful season. All I said is UCLA should win every game it should win. Wow, that's the lowest, that's the expectation, and everyone is thinking that's too high of expectation, that UCLA should win the games it should win. That kind of blew me away, some of the reactions to that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a defensible position. I mean, I think looking at the remaining five games, all of them are extremely winnable. The one that concerns me is at Arizona, more than USC, because it'll be it's not just that it's at Arizona, it's that it's at 7:30 p.m. in Tucson, and I can't remember the last good thing that happened in Arizona after like 4 p.m. Probably something from when it was still a territory. So that'll be bad. But on the flip side, I mean, they're going to be favored in... I mean, they're obviously favored this weekend against Colorado. They're going to be favored hugely against Arizona State. They're going to be favored hugely against Cal. I think by the time the USC game rolls around, it's going to be a pick'em, and the only reason it'll still be a pick'em is because of that USC offense, but that defense is tanking badly. And Arizona right now, it'd probably be UCLA by 3. We'll see what it is by game time.
And Dave, they don't have that guy. Connor Stallions? Stallions? Stallions?
Stallions.
You've heard about this guy?
Yeah.
You know, it was... So this is wild speculation. It was really crazy how well Arizona had UCLA scouted last year, right?
Well, I mean, they had a bunch of guys who were previously on the staff.
That too. I'm conceding that. But they had UCLA down. That Connor Stallions guy is a head, reportedly has ties to Arizona head coach Jed Fish. And I think was working for him at the time of last season. So I'm not saying anything really about this. I'm just saying it's interesting.
It is interesting.
And how about that? Is that a porn name? Connor Stallions? My God.
Yeah. That whole story is bizarre.
Yeah.
All right.
He bought the tickets under his own name.
Yeah. Dumbass. All right. So that's football. I think it's going to be like a 3-touchdown win. On to basketball. Tracy, you got
you
a bunch of...
You suddenly have some excitement in your voice, Dave.
Yeah. Look at the situation. So basketball is now 5 days away from the exhibition, played again at 6 p.m. on Halloween for reasons unbeknownst to gods or men. Tracy, you got some inside info this week about how basketball practice has been going. I assume we are ready to hang a banner.
Isn't that funny when I wrote that big long thing that got into all these details and then the first reaction was, so what you're saying is they're going to win a national championship. I'm basing it on what people have told me about practice and then also what we saw in our little media availability the other day. There are kind of three main takeaways. First, practice has been kind of rough, and it's rough because you got seven freshmen. College basketball, well, I could say any sport, but I know college basketball. It a huge element here is that you know what you're doing. You know where to be on offense. You know how to set a screen. You know how to cut. You know the timing. You know all of that. And most freshmen, no matter how well coached they are in high school, come in not knowing anything. It's very, very rare to have a true freshman that comes in and is actually just steps right in. And most of the time that happens because they're just so stupidly talented. All the technique and all the fundamentals almost don't even matter. Seven of them. So you can just imagine. I shouldn't be laughing, but you can just imagine.
But Mick Cronin's
frustration at practice must be volcanic.
But they're certainly all speaking the same language.
that would make it easier, too. Yeah, so that's the... And from what I've heard, obviously, there's a lot of fundamental things on offense they have to get down, but defense is so much... Yeah, you can be a really good defensive player, but it is so much about knowing what to do on defense. So... there's a lot to learn there from what I've heard. So that's the one big takeaway. On the other hand, the level of just pure talent is a little ridiculous. The one detail of talent is Adai Mara's offense. When he catches the ball anywhere within 10 feet, has been described to me as truly freakish. Not just the little left and right handed jump hooks, but he's got like this little, and the source who was describing it to me said, you can't even kind of describe it. He kind of turns and he's facing the basket. And so he's starting out at 7'3". So if he jumps, I don't know where he is in the gym. And it's just like a push shot. It's a one-handed push shot that he banks so high off the backboard, and it goes in. We saw it in that media. I think we saw it one time, but I've been told he's now getting more comfortable. He's going to it quite often, but it's just that whole arsenal of offense that we've seen, and that's not even talking about the alley-oop dunks, his ability to dunk the ball by not even getting off the floor. So the offense, his offense is truly going to be unique. And the person told me if Adai Mara, the source, if Adai Mara wasn't in practice, you would be raving about Berke Büyüktunçel, his offense and his post moves. That he has probably the best footwork among anyone on the team. Best footwork, you know, almost it was equated with Jaime Jaquez's, but I can't do that. I can't go there without having really seen it after a couple of games. But the strength of the team is going to be post-scoring. I've heard Mick Cronin turn to his guards and say, get them the effing ball. I think we're going to be being able to lip read that a lot this year when Mick's raising his voice from the sideline. And Dembona has gotten better scoring around the basket, and he's an incredible athlete who has gotten better with his post moves and his scoring ability. So they are going to go. They're going to go down low for scoring. That's the other main takeaway. They are going to play two of those guys on the court at the same time, probably all the time. So you can call it a two-post offense. And I know you're not pro that. I very much am. This whole trend that's happened over the last 10 years and where college basketball has gone to one in and four out, yeah, I get it. You know, college coaches have told me we had to do this because every 6'8 guy we're recruiting out of high school thinks he's a wing and faces up and has no post footwork at all. So it naturally became a game of one in and four out. UCLA, correct me if I'm wrong, when Cronin first arrived, he had a two-post offense, I believe, and then he quickly went to that one in and four out.
Yeah, I think he thought Cody Riley and Jalen Hill could play alongside each other, and they really couldn't.
Because that's what he was running at Cincinnati, actually. But with the rest of college basketball using the one in, four out, we saw what Arizona was capable of doing last year with two posts. And I think UCLA, the mismatches that we'll be able to generate are indefensible for a lot of teams. They will not have the personnel to match up. They'll have to put their big against a Daimara, let's say. And then they will either have to use another big, so another post player to go up against a Dembona. And if they do that, their offense is not geared for two bigs, or they're going to match up a 6'8", 210-pound wing forward, face-up four kind of guy against a Dembona. And why this really works, and why at times it didn't work for Arizona last year, is because their four, who is essentially Tabellus, couldn't sometimes match up against quicker fours. We saw that against Jaime Jaquez at times. A Dembona will be able to match up. He will be able to defend a 6'8", 210-pound, fairly quick wing forward. He will also bring the shot blocking of two shot blockers on the court. Berke is actually a very good shot blocker too. So among those three, when you have two on the court, especially a Dem, makes the defense, I think it's an advantage rather than a disadvantage to have a Dembona defending most college fours. I'll take that any day. And then the added bonus of the extra shot blocking. I like this matchup, and I'm not even talking about what it can do offensively. The high-low, the alley-oops, they'll have to, like I said, Daimara will draw the big. He might draw a double. What does that do for a Dembona who catches it at the top of the key or he's on the opposite block? There's so many things they can do here. And then defenses will have to collapse. And from what I've heard and what we saw, UCLA's outside shooting might be the inexperience is probably the biggest disadvantage in outside shooting. But if anything can help a team with its outside shooting is that it gets open looks, especially this team, which generally has across the board a slow release on their outside jumpers, except for maybe Stefanovic. So I like the way this two big offense plugs in with the personnel, mostly because of the Dembona, but also because of the rest of college basketball. Like Marquette. Marquette is going to be a tough game. You're going to be there, Dave.
I'm going to be there.
But they are an experienced, a talented team that is small. What will they do? They will have to pressure and kind of trap UCLA's perimeter guys to hope they're so rattled and they can't even get UCLA can't get touches in the paint. But what are they going to do against a 7-3 Adaimara and a 6 Temeden Bona when they actually do catch the ball in the post? I'm not saying UCLA will beat Marquette. I would right now at this point predict a loss, but that's the kind of thing. A good team like Marquette is going to be extremely small against UCLA. So I think it's exciting. I think it's kind of fun to see what Mick Cronin can do with this personnel. And I'm not even, one last thing too, this team is very good at driving and getting into the paint and in their mid-range scoring. Across the board, they're all good mid-range scorers, which will make opposing defense pack it in even more, which potentially open up more open looks on the outside. And that leads me to, and you can talk about your guy, Will McClendon.
Will McClendon has been shooting well in practice. Apparently didn't shoot well in the secret scrimmage. I mean, I think looking at the team, the thing I'm leery of is still going big, I don't like inherently have a problem with. I think there's a lot of value in what you said. It's when you're going big with your two majorly playable fives, and one's a true freshman and the other one was insanely foul prone last year. And by true freshman, I mean he's going to be insanely foul prone. Those two guys playing defense at the same time, I'd be very worried about a lot of first halves getting three fouls on both guys or two fouls on both guys, because Mick Cronin's pretty conservative about how he plays them. And then, you know, offensively, I think there's tons of value in what you've said. I do think there's a lot of matchup advantages. If we're classifying Buyuk Tunjil as a big, then I'm fine with big. Big, him and Bona. Big, him and Mara. Where I'm a little out on it is Mara and Bona playing a ton of minutes together. They're occupying a lot of the same spaces offensively. They'll force defenses to clog the middle, but they're going to get clogged up too. Their freedom to roam and kind of, you know, the advantage for a guy like Mara, yeah, he's 7'4" or whatever. But if he gets doubled, he can't bring the ball low. And what do freshman bigs do all the time? They bring the ball low because they panic. And you're going to get steals because guys will crash and double him, especially if there's guys playing on Bone. Like, it's other teams have had big, but a lot of times it's, you know, more experienced big than what UCLA is going to have playing both of those guys.
It's rife for problems. Absolutely. You can, everything you just listed, 100%, but there's really no choice. Your three best players are three post bigs.
Yeah. And so that's going to be the tricky piece. I think a lot's going to depend on Buyuk Tunjil. Like, a lot's going to depend on him being, you know, a reasonable face-up four. I don't think he's going to be what Jaime was as, like, a, you know, what is a classic college four, like 6'6". But if he can play a little bit out on the perimeter and open up some spacing on the interior for the true big, I think that's going to be the ideal makeup. And obviously he still has a lot of his own post skills too, but I think a lot's going to depend on him playing that role, because I do think there's a reason why in college basketball, four out, one in has become kind of the rule. And it is, some of it's the big skill, but some of it is also just the spacing. Like, there's not as much space on the floor. So the only way to get a proper amount of space so you can hit some threes and do all that kind of stuff is with a four out, one in. But you're right. I mean, they're going to have to experiment with different things, because it doesn't, you know, from everything, it doesn't sound like this is going to be a super elite perimeter scoring team from three-point land. But also, it's just a lot of young guys. They're going to make a lot of young guy mistakes. There's going to be a lot of Jules Bernard drives to nowhere. Just it's going to happen, especially those first 2 months, which I keep cautioning everybody. Those first 2 months, they are not going to be great. But there's I'm very interested to see how Cronin ends up approaching this, not just game one, but how this is looking come December. You know, what does he rule out? What does he think is working? All that kind of stuff. This experimenting period in the first 2 months of the season, I think, is going to be really interesting, and especially how it portends for January and February.
And especially if there are some guys who are sitting out.
Yes.
Which might happen.
Yes.
At the beginning of the season. And yes. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yes. Yes. Great. That's a great note to leave on, Tracy. I love
well,
it.
Okay. Do you want to? I had to include it.
Should I sing a song? What should I do?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, please.
I like to sing about the moon and I don't know. Okay. Well, that's about it for us. Tracy just left a little turd in the punch bowl on his way out. But it's still a party.
I'm just picturing that. I'm getting a visual.
Yeah. All right. So UCLA.
The whole process of a guy getting up, like you're at a party and there's a punch bowl and.
Yeah. Are you squatting on the banquet table? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you've got all that. You got that image in your mind now. So we're leaving you with.
Take that with you throughout the day.
Yeah. Take it with you for the rest of your life if you can. And UCLA takes on Colorado not tomorrow. This is not Friday. This is Thursday. Takes on Colorado in 2 days at 4:30. I think it's on ABC. Enjoy the game if you're going. Have fun. And we'll talk to you again next time.
See y'all.
It's the UEFA Champions League on Paramount Plus. Europe's top club soccer tournament. Champions versus champions. The best teams facing off in the knockout rounds.
Magnificent!
And it all takes place
while you're filling out financial reports at work. In the middle of your day, in the middle of your week. So use that second screen. Call in sick. Do whatever you gotta do to tune in Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Nobody watches the UEFA Champions League like us. Stream every match live exclusively on Paramount Plus.